And he's on it.
A.J. Foyt has won his fourth 500-mile race.
It's a drag race. Marco Andretti, Cornish, who's going to win? At the stripe, it's home.
Goodyear makes a move. Little Al wins by just a few tenths of a second.
You just don't know what Indy means.
More Front Wings Centennial Interview Series.
Welcome back to another episode of More Front Wings Indy Centennial Interview Series. This morning we're joined by four-time winner of the 500, Mr. Al Unser. Al, thank you very much for joining us again today.
Well, thanks for calling me, Paul. It's a pleasure being able to talk with all of you.
Well, thank you. Let's just quickly go over your stats then real quick, Al. 27 starts. You were part of that sensational rookie class of 1965. It drove all the way through 1993 with a couple misses in 69 and 91. Of course, we know the four wins that you had in 70, 71, 78, and 87. You won your first one in 70 from the pole. You still, to this day, are the all-time lap leader at Indianapolis with 647 laps led, and you're second in all-time laps completed at 4,356. To get us started here, Al, if you would, can you take us back to 1965 and talk a little bit about that just sensational class that you came in with yourself and Mario and Gordon Johncock and Joe Leonard and so many other great names from that era?
Well, back then, you know, there was the rookies were a different. I think they looked at rookies in a different way than they do today. You had to take a test that was very difficult. I know that the rookies think that the ones today are, but they're not. They're very simple because of the type of cars and everything. But, you know, it was something that I totally dreamed about, being able to maybe one day go into Indianapolis and then making the race, and it all came true that year in 65. So, you know, it was a difficult month. It was not an easy time.
Al, if we were going to pick one win to highlight of your four, the one that we would gravitate toward is 1987. There are certainly a lot of stories connected with your month of May that year. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, your first one's always, I think, very important to you, you know, because you really want to sit down and ask yourself, did I really do it? You know, you want to do it so badly. And then when it's accomplished, you think, man, is this a dream? But, you know, again, then the next year I came back and won again. I thought, boy, this is pretty neat. I like this. And then there was a dry spell until 78, you know, and then I think the last one, because I came to Indianapolis without a ride and I wanted a good team and things, the way it worked out, Penske called me after they wouldn't release Danny Andreas to run his third car. So it was a year-old car and an obsolete motor, supposedly. But, you know, we ended up winning the race, and I think that was really something to be able to. They didn't give me a chance. They figured I'd run up front, maybe. But then to win the race, it's just, you know, a fantastic feeling and an accomplishment that the team and I were very proud of.
You started getting into it a little bit, but if you were to think through your four wins each individually and try to compare them and come up with a highlight from each one, would you be able to do that for us?
Well, yeah, I think so. You know, when I first went back there and won the first race in 70, we kind of knew that if the car finished and if everything went good in 1970, that we would probably win the race. And then 71 came, and all of a sudden we thought we had an advantage still, and all of a sudden during the month of May we found that we didn't. And in 71, it was a very difficult race. I had to run very hard all day to outrun the competition, and if Mark Donahue would have finished that year, he'd have, you know, chances that he was going to outrun me very easily.
Mm-hmm.
And then Peter Revson, you know, he just, we were a lot smarter in the pits and on the racetrack than he was, I guess you can call it, because he, you know, was a rookie, kind of, and he didn't really understand what was going on. And then 78 was a year that again, I can honestly say we didn't think that we had a winning car. And all of a sudden, during the month of May, we figured that. And then race day, all of a sudden, you know, we were running up front and leading the race. And I says, boy, this is, you know, it was a surprise, kind of. And end up winning the race with Jim Hall, his first year there, you know. And it just was terrific on that standpoint. And then, again, I'll come back to 87, you know, I didn't have a ride and went back there and ended up getting a ride with Penske and ended up winning the race, qualifying the second weekend. And those kind of deals back then were just kind of unheard of. You just didn't have those advantages, qualifying the second weekend and a year-old car and supposedly an obsolete engine and all that, and, you know, you end up winning the race. And I think it just shows what kind of team that Penske has, and he's since then showed it many times. So, it's terrific.
Al, can you talk a little bit about what it was like working with Roger Penske? You certainly had a lot of experience with that.
Well, Roger's a man that wants to win. He just absolutely... it's a must for his cars to run up front and to try to win. And he's just a terrific man. The guy, when he says he's going to do something, he does it.
Al, you've been at the Speedway now for, 45, 46 years. Obviously, a lot of things have changed, not only with the Speedway and the race, but just how the whole month of May has evolved. As you look back over your time, what do you see as the... how the Speedway and the race has evolved, and what are some of the bigger changes that you can see as you look back now?
Well, I think that the Speedway has grown so much. When Tony George decided to build new grandstands and new garages for F1 and redid the garages in the back there from the old wooden garages. I mean, you can just look around, and Tony George, as far as I'm concerned, just upgraded the place 300 times. And that, you know, from when I first went there, and they opened it up to stock cars for NASCAR and for F1 and now motorcycles and no telling what else. I mean, they take a plant that is absolutely out of this world, and he's made it better and better every year, and they have, and Tony was the first one that started it, and his father. But, you know, it just keeps increasing in sight of the spectators. It's nicer than any place we run, even today. And pays the most money and gives the most recognition. And so, therefore, and it shows. You know, people, when you go somewhere, they don't ask if you've won Phoenix or whatever other race you want to talk about, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. They want to know, have you ever raced at Indianapolis? Yes. Did you ever, you know, win it? Well, yes. And that's basically what they ask. So, the place was just, you know, carries a lot of prestige.
Oh, absolutely. You started talking about the fact that Indianapolis doesn't just run IndyCars anymore. They get into they've hosted F1 no longer, of course, but they also have the Brickyard 400 and the MotoGP. There are two camps on this. There are people who feel that running anything other than IndyCars at Indy is the wrong thing to do, and it's against tradition. And there are people who think that expanding into these other areas is a benefit to the Speedway. How do you feel about that?
Well, myself, I think the ones that feel that and it should only be IndyCars, they don't know what they're talking about. If I owned that place, I've always said this, if I owned it, I'd have every type of racing in the world, because everybody should enjoy a plant like that. In other words, regardless whether you're a stock car fan, a road racing fan, a motorcycle fan, or an Indy fan, you should all be able to, because if you don't like stock cars, you won't come to the stock car race. So, I mean, it's just a place that should all types of racing should be able to go enjoy. And the people that think that it should only be an Indianapolis car racetrack, I think are very wrong.
Al, over your great career, you've had the chance to run with some of the greatest drivers in history and work right alongside with them as teammates. Can you touch a little bit about some of the teammates that you've had through the years and what you've been able to learn and glean from some of those teammates?
Well, you know, the teammates, when you have a teammate, you get along with him or you don't. And I think basically all my teammates that I've had, Andretti, Leonard, you know, that are good. They were very good teammates. I mean, you just, and to have car owners as your boss, like Parnelli Jones. I mean, he understood. Parnelli Jones was one of the fastest running men at the speedway there ever has been. And, you know, just as teammates over the years, and as competitors to one another, I really don't have anybody that I really think is bad for racing. You know, there's some guys sometimes you don't get along with a little bit and all that, but as a whole, you have to get along with everybody, because once you fasten that seatbelt and the green flag goes down, you have to respect each other and know what each other's doing. So it's very important, I think, to understand your competitors, your teammates, and to get along.
Al, if we asked you to name a driver who you felt was the best that you ever raced against at Indy, could you do that?
Oh, my gosh. I could, you know, I'd have to get a book out here and list them all, you know, like Jim Herdebees, Parnelli, Gordon Johnhock, Mariel, Foyt, McElreath, I mean, there's just so many that on a given day, you look at the winners that has happened over the years of all types of racing, and you can say at any given point at different racetracks, they were the strongest, and you had to outrun them. Because you won today doesn't mean you can win next weekend, you know, at a race. So because they all, you learn once you become a winner, regardless whether it's on short track, long tracks, or where, next week you are the one they want to outrun. And when you take 30, 40 guys trying to outrun you, it doesn't take much for you to step on your toes, you know, and make the wrong decisions about the handling of the car just a tiny bit. And all of a sudden, they have it figured out and you don't. And next week, when you go to another race, you have to then try to outrun them. So there's just so many guys over the years that have so much talent that it's just unbelievable. That's what makes, when you reach the top of IndyCar racing, stock cars, sports cars, you run against the very best there is. And it's hard to outrun them. It's not simple. You might think that you're better than they are, but I'll guarantee you when that green flag goes down, they have all intentions of trying to outrun you just like you have to outrun them.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me expand on that just a little bit, Al. You mentioned some of the names like Jim Herdebees and Jim McElreath. And is there a driver that you look back at now and think that maybe history hasn't been quite fair to them and maybe they don't get the recognition that they deserve for being the driver that they were?
Oh, there's many of them. Lloyd Ruby. In other words, you can just go down. Lloyd Ruby never did win Indianapolis, and he should have many times. You know, the ones that don't win Indy and they run up front, you often wonder why. Look at Mario Andretti. He only won one race there at Indy, but look at his record otherwise. I mean, the guy was, you know, Parnelli Jones only won one race at Indy, and he should have won many. So, you know, there's just many drivers that have had the talent, but they just some way drop in luck, I guess. I don't know how to word that, because it's sad that they have everything going for them, but yet they never did win.
Al, that brings up an interesting question. You talk about all the guys that you consider to be so talented who didn't win as often, frankly, as you did. Would you attribute that to your own talent and your own ability to outrun them, or do you really think that is luck?
The team. You have to have yourself dialed in and the team. Who makes the less mistakes? You know, during the day, your pit men, you have to go from your whole team and yourself. Do you make less mistakes than the other drivers? Does the team make less mistakes? Does the management of your team and owners make less mistakes? Yes. There's more to it than just luck. You know, you can cover luck in many ways. You can say, well, he's just not lucky, or he's really lucky. But why are certain drivers and certain people better than others in luck or in talent or in whatever you want to call it?
This next one is a two-part question. Can you give us your single favorite memory of your time at the Speedway, and then after that, your greatest disappointment?
Well, I can tell you about the disappointments real quick. It's the ones you don't finish that you
right.
think that you have a chance of winning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the disappointments are when a fellow driver gets hurt and gets killed and things like that. It's sad that the disappointments in racing are just like in any sport. There's good times and bad times, but, you know, the bad times you don't like to remember. The good times is when you're talked about and you're able to hold your head up and be very proud of winning a race and beating the very best that there is. Then next week you go back and you can't beat those same guys, and you really ask why. You know, you ask yourself, you ask your team that you're driving for, what happened this week that we couldn't win? So you
right.
want to win each and every race that you go to.
Let's switch topics a little bit again here, Al. You know, just carrying the name Unser at Indianapolis, arguably the greatest family in the history of the race, and certainly you have far and away more wins there than any other family between yourself and your son and your brother. Talk a little bit about what it just means to carry that name, Unser, at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Well, when my brother Jerry went back there in 58 and had his bad luck and got killed in 59 there, it's sad. You know, you sit back and you ask yourself, I was already in racing, running super modifieds here in Albuquerque and around. And you say, boy, why did that happen? He was only, I think, 25 or 26 years old, Jerry was, when he got killed. And then for Bobby to go back, and Bobby had bad luck at first. He got, you know, crashed the first time. He spun out the Novi, the very first lap or second lap, and hit the wall. And then in the next year, he got caught in the fire of Sachs McDonald and all that. You say, boy, gee whiz, is that place for me? But I wanted to go. I wanted to race, and Indianapolis was the, you know, as far as I was concerned back then, was the greatest spectacle in racing. It was something that, you know, that you want to do, and you the drive to go there and compete is just unbelievable. And then, you know, be able to go back there, and then all of a sudden you say as a rookie you pass your rookie test, and then you try to qualify for the race, and I went through heck the first year there of trying to get qualified, and Foyt came along and put me in his second car, and I says, man, you know, and he just helped me out tremendously, and I made the race and ended up finishing ninth that year, and it just opened up my career by somebody like Foyt stepping up and helping a rookie. And then I run for Granatelli the next year in Team Lotus and was competitive. I run up front all day and finally crashed and all that. The car broke, whatever happened. And so your career just keeps going up towards Indianapolis, and then you're able to, you know, finally win the race, and it's just a great feeling.
Well, you're the only winner who's also been able to watch their son go on and watch the race. First when Al won in 92 and again in 94. What was that like to know what he was going through as his father?
Well, you know, I've raced against my brother every year, my whole life. And I learned one thing when my son came along. Things change when it's your own kids, female or male. And when all of a sudden I started watching Al running when he was running go-karts and then the formula cars and Super Vs and sports cars and then sprint cars, I mean, it just used to just turn my stomach upside down and scare me to death. I learned very quickly that I didn't know how my parents put up with all four of us brothers. Because racing against my brother was very easy. I wanted to outrun him as he wanted to outrun me. But you don't have that same, you have a fear of your family member getting injured, or you hope it doesn't happen. But it's not near as deep as it is with your own kids. And I didn't realize that until Al got involved in racing. And it just absolutely used to drive me out of my mind. You know, I would even go to some of the races that he raced in just because I'd get so worked up and overexcited, I guess, or sad, whatever you want to call it, when he had bad luck.
Al, you've alluded to fear a few times in some of the responses that you've given us. And of course, when you started racing, things were so very much more dangerous than they are now. Can you talk a little bit about how, as a professional race car driver, you dealt with that fear and overcame it to continue doing what you love to do?
Well, you must understand that when I came along, the era of when I went to Indianapolis in 65 and before that, the drivers that run Indy before me, you know, there must have been five or six a year get killed back in those days. And when I came along, all the drivers before me said, boy, we never had the safety features that you guys have today. And then it's just like that now. I can look at the safety that the cars are today, they're so much more safer. The equipment that you wear, the helmets, the seat belts, everything, the fuel cells, the cars themselves are stronger and designed to protect the driver a lot more. In open wheel cars like sprint cars or the big dirt track cars, you know, they make you wear armor strengths, and there's just so many more things that are safety wise today. And I can say the same thing when I first started, that there was so much more safety than there was before me that it's unbelievable, you know. When I first started racing, you know, here I go talking about it differently in my age, but I didn't even have roll bars. Mm-hmm. And they put the single roll bar, and then they went to caged roll bars. And the rear engine cars, they didn't have fuel cells at first, and then they started with fuel cells, and we carried 75 gallons of fuel, and when you crashed, I mean, you ruptured the fuel tank. There was a big fire, as a lot of people can remember and remember seeing the fire. Alcohol's hard to see when it burns, but just things like that, you know, you can talk all day about the safety of today versus yesterday.
One last question for you, Al. Not only are you one of only 67 drivers who has earned the right to call himself an Indy 500 champion, but you did it four times. Can you talk about what it means to you to be able to wear that label?
Well, I'm very proud of it. In other words, it's something that I love is racing, and I wished I could back up in age and do it again, but God has a funny way of working on you. He retards your timing, as I call it, your eyesight, your reflexes, and your ability from the standpoint of I know that I can't keep up with the kids today. There just isn't any way that your reflexes and your desire maybe is there, but everything else isn't. And the desire only goes so far. So, you know, it's very difficult to run against the kids today, because I call them, they have no fear. They do, but they don't. They're very talented young men and women, and they just are terrific when you watch them run. You know, I've said many times, I said, well, I never did pull those things, and there's the elderly people older than me watched me come up. They said, oh, yes, you did, Al. You did the same thing. But you don't realize that when you're young, you have no fear and only one desire, and that's to try to win the race.
Well, and win the race you certainly did. Al, it has been a true pleasure to speak with you today. We certainly appreciate you taking some time out of your day to talk about your Indianapolis memories. And we certainly congratulate you on the stellar career that you had, and like we touched on a little bit, being part of that Unser legacy. So,
well, if you ever come through Albuquerque, we have a museum here that we built, the wife and I, and so we would love to have you come in and see it, and we have a charter school and a challenger school and a charter learning center.
Well, that will be on our list when I do make it out to Albuquerque. I've heard nothing but rave reviews of the museum, and I think it's something that every race fan should put on their list to enjoy for sure.
Well, we'd enjoy seeing everybody. We really would. And you know, I love showing off everything that we have here, because it covers the Unser family from top to bottom.
Well, again, Al, we certainly appreciate you taking some time to speak with us. We wish you the best of luck on the museum and the schools, and we look forward to seeing you during the month of May.
Well, don't put too much front wing in your chapter here, because when you put a lot of front wing, you spin out.
We will try to avoid that. And thank you again for joining us on More Front Wing Centennial Interview Series. Join us next time as we conclude our series, and we also wrap up our month of May coverage here in the coming days as we continue to look forward to this weekend's running of the Centennial Anniversary Indianapolis 500. And remember that More Front Wing is your source online for blogs, podcasts, photos, and more covering the Eyes Out IndyCar Series and beyond.